Well, it's good to see you all again. I have been discussing the attributes of God, and it's because a couple years ago I was thinking about the model prayer, and of course Jesus laid down a foundation, an outline for how we should pray. And one of the things that he said was, hallowed be thy name. Now, he intended for us to be giving praise to God in prayer. And just to say, hallowed be thy name, doesn't quite cut it. And I was thinking that I am, and maybe you are, where Job was before he met God face to face. And Job said to God, I've heard of you by the hearing of your ear, but now, having been confronted by God, he said, now my eye sees you. And I think that we need to see God more clearly to understand him better in order to give him the praise in prayer that he deserves and desires. You remember that Jesus said to the woman at the well, the Father is seeking people who will worship him in spirit and in truth. And we need to know the truth about the attributes and the nature of God. And so I've been discussing the attributes of God. I don't speak down here as often as I speak in the other congregations, but I've been giving a series of sermons about the attributes of God. And I think the last time I was here, I talked to you about how we worship the compassionate God. Today, I want to talk about the sovereign God. I want to talk today about the sovereignty of God, what that means, and how the sovereignty of God has been challenged and will continue to be challenged throughout the ages. As long as there are men on the face of the earth, the sovereignty of God is going to come under attack. Now, in the past, we've said that it's the potential of Christians to become like God. And this idea, you remember that the old literature used to say that God is reproducing himself. And when I first started to read the literature, I thought, God is reproducing himself? What in the world does that mean? And as I read the literature more, I realized that what was really intended was that the church was teaching that God is reproducing his kind. God is creating a family of beings of the same kind as himself. I've reproduced twice, and neither time did I reproduce myself. Aren't we all grateful for that? I reproduced my kind. And that's what God is doing. God is reproducing his kind. But that's caused some in years past, decades ago, for a while we heard people asking the question, will we be God as God is God? And it kind of sounds like double talk, doesn't it? Who ever heard this question being asked? A couple old timers have heard that question. Will we be God as God is God? And I think the question being raised there was, will we have the sovereignty that God has? And the answer is no, we won't. Sovereignty is the ability to exercise supreme authority. And the Father has granted that to Jesus Christ, hasn't he? Jesus said, all power, all authority in heaven and earth has been given to me. So the Father has shared that with Jesus Christ. But sovereignty, the ability to exercise supreme authority, is going to rest with God the Father and with Jesus Christ. So today we're going to study the sovereignty of God so we know a little bit more about God, so that we may pray and praise God in truth to a greater, slightly greater degree. And we're going to study how the sovereignty of God has been challenged and will continue to be challenged throughout the history of man. So, first of all, the first point about the sovereignty of God is that God is free to do anything that he wants to do. God has the authority to do anything he desires to do. Just jot down Psalm 135, verse 6. I'll read it to you, just a one-liner. Psalm 135, verse 6. Whatever the Lord pleases, he does in heaven, on the earth, in the seas, and in all deep places. So God has the authority to do anything that he wants to do in heaven, in the heavenly realm, in the realm of eternity, and in the realm of temporary things here on the earth. God is free to do all that he wants to do. So God has the authority to do whatever he desires, wherever. His freedom to do so extends through heaven and on the earth as well. And there's no one who can question what he does. But not only that, his sovereignty extends through time and space as well. Isaiah 46, verse 10. You might want to turn there. That's actually two lines. Isaiah 46, verse 10. God says of himself that he is the one who declares the end from the beginning. So at the beginning of creation, he knew what the end of creation would be. From ancient times, things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand, and I shall do all my pleasure. So God's sovereignty extends from the heavens, the realm of eternity, throughout the earth, the physical realm, the realm of temporary things. And not only that, throughout all space and time. God is sovereign over time. Now, not only does God have the authority to do whatever he wants to do, God has the power and the ability to do whatever he wills. He has the power, the strength, the know-how to carry out his every desire. Nothing is too hard for him to do. Job 42 and verse 2. We'll look at three examples where the Bible states that God is able to do anything that he sets his mind to do. Job 42, verse 2, this is after Job has seen God face to face. I know that you can do everything and that no purpose of yours can be withheld from you. And we'll look at examples in the Bible of people who tried to withhold God's purpose from him and they were easily overcome. No purpose of God's is going to be thwarted. And things that seem impossible to us are easy for God. Luke 1 talks about Mary's encounter with Gabriel, the angel. And Gabriel comes to her in verse 30 of Luke 1, and he tells her that she's about to have a very great honor bestowed on her because she's found favor with God. And the angel tells her she's going to conceive, and he tells her that she should call her son's name Jesus. In verse 32, he shall be great, he shall be called the Son of the Highest. And the Lord God shall give unto him the throne of his father David. And that Gabriel makes prophecies about the work of the Messiah. And she says, well, how can this be? She says, I haven't known a man. And Gabriel says to her, the Holy Spirit shall come upon you, and the power of the Highest shall overshadow you. Therefore also, that holy thing which shall be born of you shall be called the Son of God. And behold, your cousin Elizabeth, she has also conceived a son in her old age. And this is the sixth month with her who was called barren. And then Gabriel says in verse 37, for with God nothing shall be impossible. Whatever God sets his mind to do, whatever his will, his desire is, He has the power to do it. And Jesus reinforced this after his birth, and 30-some-odd years later, after his mother had been visited by the angel, Jesus in Matthew 19, verse 26, Jesus looked at them and said to them, "With men, this is impossible." We all have limitations. Men and women, human physical beings, have limitations. There are things that are impossible for us, but Jesus said, "But with God, all things are possible." So, Paul pointed out, let's turn to Ephesians 3:20. Paul pointed out that God's capabilities are so vast that we can't even imagine. We are incapable of imagining what God is able to do. It's beyond our ability to conceive. In our wildest, most fantastic dreams, we still can't come close to defining in our minds what is possible for God. Paul's trying to encourage the Ephesians to pray, and he says, "Now to him who is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we ask or think, according to the power that works in us." So we can't even come up with, in our most fantastic imaginations, we cannot imagine what God is capable of doing. So God rules and reigns over the heaven and the earth. He rules over his creation. God is sovereign over history. The history of man is going to be written in part by man's own stupid mistakes. And yet God is there trying to guide us towards some kind of a safe landing. God is sovereign over human history, and God will cause it to turn out the way that he desires. God is sovereign, we have to remember, over individual human life. God is sovereign over your life and mine. James 4:15 says, what James is talking about, men who brag about what they're going to do and what they're going to accomplish. And James says, instead of bragging about what we're going to do, we ought to say, "If the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that." So God is sovereign over our lives. God is sovereign over principalities, powers, angels, and demonic forces. You remember that it says that Jesus created principalities. He created powers. Jesus created everything that's in heaven, everything that's invisible, everything that's permanent. The things that are unseen, Paul tells us, are permanent. Jesus created all those. He created principalities. But he also created principalities on the earth. You remember that when Gabriel wanted to see Daniel, he had to fight his way past the prince of Persia. So that was a principality. That's a throne. There is a throne somewhere, and there is a demonic power, an angel, sitting on this throne, and he's in charge of this principality. But in Colossians 1:16, it says, "For by him, Jesus, all things were created that are in heaven and on the earth, visible or invisible, whether they're thrones or dominions or principalities or powers, all things were created through him and for him." And he is still in power over all those other powers and principalities. Now, this is a very important principle. It's something that I learned in this study, and it's something that I haven't heard before, but I see the truth of it as I went through and studied the scriptures. God is sovereign, and we have had sovereign kings over the earth. David and Solomon were sovereign rulers over the nation of Israel. And every king on this earth, as a symbol of his sovereignty, has built a throne. The throne of the king, whether it's a king on this earth or whether it's God, that throne is a symbol of the ruler's sovereignty. God's throne is a symbol of his sovereignty, a very important principle. You need to fix that in your mind. If you learn one thing in this sermon, a ruler's throne is a symbol of his sovereignty. Let's turn over to 1 Kings 10 and verse 18. You know who had the largest and the tallest and the most opulent, the most splendid throne that's ever been on the earth? You know who that was? King Solomon. Let's read about King Solomon's throne and understand why he felt it necessary to have such a throne. It says, moreover, this is 1 Kings 10, verse 18. Moreover, the king made a great throne of ivory and overlaid it with the best gold. Now, I imagine that the ivory was elephant tusks, and he had a throne constructed out of ivory, and yet it was overlaid with gold. Now, I would think that he would want the ivory to be showing through the gold, so perhaps the gold was hammered into a kind of a filigree pattern, and there must have been designs in the gold so that you could see the ivory through the gold. He overlaid it with the best gold. And the throne had six steps. Six steps. Can you imagine the six steps? I guess that would be about six steps, wouldn't it? If I had six steps, they'd be about that high. So Solomon had to go up six steps to sit on his throne. And then every throne had a footstool. So he'd stand up on the footstool, and then he'd sit on his throne. So when he's sitting on his throne, he's way up there. If you came in to talk to Solomon, you'd be looking up at Solomon like that. He'd be way up high above you. That height was a symbol of his authority and his sovereignty and his supremacy and his power. The throne had six steps, and the top of the throne was round behind, and there were stays on either side on the place of the seat. And two lions stood by the stays, and 12 lions stood there on one side, and on the other side upon the six steps. There was not the like of it in any kingdom. Nobody ever had a throne that was this grand, this opulent, this beautiful, this tall. To have an audience with Solomon, you'd have to crane your neck. You'd have to lean back and look like this. And maybe you were kneeling before him. I don't know if people were allowed to stand in the presence of the king. Maybe you had to kneel when you went in there. Maybe if you were kneeling, you had a hard time seeing Solomon's face. The height of Solomon's throne was a demonstration of his greatness. Now, God also has a throne. And in Revelation 4, John the Apostle is seeing a vision of heaven. Who's good with numbers? Who's good with counting? Okay, Margaret, it's you. Margaret, your sole function for the next 30 seconds is to count the number of times the word throne appears in Revelation 4. I'm going to read it. Okay, just make a little tick mark every time I say throne. Revelation 4, John says, after this I looked, and behold, a door was opened in heaven. And the first voice which I heard was, as it were, of a trumpet talking with me, said, come up here thither. And now this is King James. And I will show you the things which must be hereafter. Here we go, Margaret. Verse 2. Immediately I was in the spirit, and behold, a throne was set in heaven. Now, compare the number of times John mentions the throne with the number of times he mentions God. I'll tell you, he mentions God twice in this chapter. Immediately I was in the spirit, behold, a throne was set in heaven. One sat on the throne, and he that sat was to look at like a jasper and a sardine stone, and there was a rainbow around the throne, in sight like an emerald. Round about the throne were 24 seats, and upon the seats I saw 24 elders sitting clothed in white raiment, and they had on their heads crowns of gold. And out of the throne proceeded lightnings and thunderings and voices. And there were 7 lamps burning before the throne, which are the 7 spirits of God. And before the throne there was a sea of glass like crystal. And in the middle of the throne and round about the throne were 4 beasts full of eyes in front and behind. Oh, sorry. Okay, let's skip down to verse 9. When the beasts give glory and honor to him that sat on the throne, who lives forever and ever, the 24 elders fall down before him that sat on the throne and worshiped him that lived forever and ever and cast their crowns before the throne, saying, "You are worthy, O Lord, to receive glory and honor and power, for you have created all things, and for your pleasure they were created." How many times?
13.
Okay. All right. Well, it mentions God maybe 2 or 4 times. But the throne of God, the throne, not God, not the person of God, but the throne of God is the central point in this vision. It's the most prominent part of John's vision. It's mentioned, Margaret says, 13 times in this chapter, and it continues into chapter 5. He continues to talk about the throne. The throne is vitally important because the throne is a symbol of God's power and supremacy and sovereignty. Everything John sees in this vision is described in its relationship to the throne. It's the central point in John's description of God's court in heaven. This throne is must be a very large, very tall, magnificent piece of furniture, vastly more opulent than Solomon's. In his vision, John is overcome. He's preoccupied. He's obsessed with this throne that he's seen in the throne room of God, because the throne is a symbol of God's sovereignty. Now, we'll see some scriptures that demonstrate how the throne is the symbol of God's sovereignty, of his rule, of its longevity in his office. The throne is the symbol. So what comes out of the throne is an expression of that sovereignty, of that rule, of that power. What comes out of the throne of God? Verse 5. Out of the throne proceeds lightnings and thunderings and voices. Thunder and lightning are an expression of God's sovereignty. Does that make sense? The throne is a symbol of God's sovereignty. What comes out of the throne is an expression of that sovereignty. Now, like Solomon's throne, God's throne is very high, illustrating his very great and exclusive authority. Let's look at Isaiah 6. Quickly turn to Isaiah 6 and verse 1. This happened at the beginning of Isaiah's service as a prophet. In the year that King Uzziah died, Isaiah 6, 1, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. So God's throne, like Solomon's throne, is very high. Perhaps that's one thing about the throne, aside from the lightnings that were proceeding out of it, that made John so interested in the throne when he had his vision of heaven. Now, the Bible uses a figure of speech that we're familiar with. We hear it every day. If I said to you, well, the White House said today that tariffs on Chinese goods will increase. We all know what that means. The White House said it. That means that either the president or somebody in the president's staff made an announcement about policy, right? If I say the White House said this, we know that it came from the president or from his staff. That figure of speech is called metonymy, where we have a symbol of something expressing an opinion or news or some message, and we know that it's really coming, whereas it says the White House said this, we know that it's really coming from the president. That figure of speech is called metonymy, and the Bible is full of it. Here are some examples. Psalm 45, verse 6. This is why I say that the throne is a symbol of God's sovereignty. Psalm 45, verse 6. says, "Your throne, O God, is forever." Now, is he talking about the throne? He's not really talking about the throne. He's talking about God's rule, right? He's not saying that this piece of furniture is going to last forever. He's saying, since the throne will last forever, your rule, God, your authority, your supremacy, your sovereignty is forever. But he didn't say that of God. He said it of the throne. It's like saying the White House said today, or the current administration, the current administration will be in office for another year at least, right? So when the psalmist says, "Your throne, O God, is forever," he's really saying, "Your rule, God, is forever," right? Psalm 93, verse 2. "Your throne is established from old. You are from everlasting." Same principle. He's not saying that the throne existed. He's saying that God's sovereignty has existed from old, from ancient times, and that it would continue forever. One more, Lamentations 5, verse 19. Lamentations 5, verse 19. "You, O Lord, remain forever, your throne from generation to generation." He's not just saying that the throne is going to last. It's a very durable piece of furniture. It's not what he's saying. He's saying that God's authority, God's rule, God's supremacy, God's sovereignty will last from generation to generation. So God's rule, his sovereignty, is permanent, and it has existed from the beginning, and it will remain forever. That's what these things are saying when they talk about God's throne. They're really talking about God's rule. Now, right now we get news. If you turn on the 6 o'clock news, you hear the White House said today, but it's not going to be that way in the kingdom of God. In the kingdom of God, you'll turn on the 6 o'clock news, and they'll say, "This just in from the throne of God," right? It won't be from the White House, it'll be from the throne of God. And when that happens, you know that Jesus Christ has made a policy statement, or he's made an announcement, or someone on his staff is transmitting policy to us. This directly from the throne of God. Not from the White House any longer, but from the throne of God. Well, we see that the throne of God is a very important symbol of the authority, the autonomy, the supremacy, the sovereignty of God. And that's going to be important in a few minutes. Now, one of the important principles that no one is going to learn in the first 7,000 years of man's history, well, some are going to learn it, but not everybody's going to learn it. God's sovereignty cannot successfully be contested. And you would think, well, who would do a dumb thing like that? Well, I'm going to show you four. There are six. There are six insurrections against the sovereignty of God. Who knows what the first one was? Who can point me to a scripture somewhere? How about Isaiah 14, verse 14? This is the first recorded challenge to the sovereignty of God. But in this challenge, we see the pattern of many more challenges afterward. Isaiah 14, verse 14. This is an angelic being. In the King James Bible, he's called Lucifer, which means light bringer. The word in the Hebrew is actually Hillel. Hillel is the Hebrew name. Lucifer is a Latin word. Lucifer and Hillel both mean the same thing. They mean light bringer. Isaiah 14, 14, this very gifted individual named Lucifer became ambitious. Ambition. He says in verse 14 of Isaiah 14, "I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High," he thought. His motive, he wanted to ascend to heaven. He wanted to be like God. Did he think that he could force God somehow to accede part of his power, part of his sovereignty to Lucifer? Did he intend to force God off his throne and replace him completely? His method was that he was division. He began a program of sedition, and he actually turned a third of the angels against God. He swayed one third of the angels, and there must be hundreds of millions, according to John's description. He saw 10,000 times 10,000 angels. He saw hundreds of millions of angels in heaven. Jesus Christ created every one of these. And he subverted a third of them. To support him in his attempt to topple the Father, or to make him share his authority, or somehow to create a rival principality or one that was above the throne of God. The first recorded war, Revelation 12. Imagine the first war was in heaven, of all places. That just seems like such a paradox to me, that the first war was in heaven. But the Father and the Logos were not deceived. They were aware somehow of this planned attack and prepared for it. And while I was thinking about that, I've known for a long time that there was a war in heaven. But have you ever thought, on earth, war is a matter of killing more of the enemy soldiers than they can kill of yours? So you've studied the Civil War, and you think there are ghastly casualty statistics. 50,000 in 3 days at Gettysburg, 23,000 casualties in 1 day at Antietam. Terrible numbers of casualties, carnage, torn human bodies. That's the purpose of war here on the earth. But as far as we know, spirit beings can't be hurt or killed. So what was war like in heaven? How do you have war against beings that can't be hurt or killed? Swords, spears, bows, rifles, poison gas, explosive, atomic weapons wouldn't have had any effect on them, as far as I can understand. So I thought, was it just a colossal shoving match? Men, when you were little, who played King of the Hill? Y'all played King of the Hill. Was that what it was like? Were they just trying to restrain God and drag him off his throne somehow? Think about that. If you come up with something, let me know. What was that war in heaven like? Were there weapons? What kind of weapons would be effective against spirit beings? Did Lucifer intend to restrain the Father and restrain the Logos somehow? Incarcerate them, perhaps? Ultimately, that's what happened to him. Hillel was defeated in his attempt. What was his goal? Who remembers? What was his goal? He wanted what? He wanted to be like the Most High. He wanted to be like God. Let's look at Revelation 12 and verse 7, because Lucifer and his one-third of the angels were defeated. Does someone know how to make it colder in here? I see people fanning themselves. No? Nobody knows how? There was war in heaven. This is Revelation 12, verse 7. There was war in heaven, of all places, and Michael and his angels fought against the dragon. That's Satan. And the dragon fought and his angels and prevailed not. Neither was place found any more for them in heaven. And the great dragon was cast out, the old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceives the whole world. He was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. And I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, Now has come salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ, for the accuser of our brethren is cast down, which accused them night and day before our God. Now, Satan, who was striving to be like God, was defeated by Michael, right? It says Michael and his angels fought, and they beat the devil. Do you know what Michael means? I guess it's three Hebrew words. Michael is probably how it would be pronounced. Satan wanted to be like God. He was defeated by Michael, whose name means who is like God. Isn't that awesome? The one who would be like God was defeated by one whose name is who is like God. So God is alone in his sovereignty and his power and his great capacity. And although a very great and powerful force tried and challenged him, he cannot be challenged. He cannot be toppled from power. He cannot be defeated. Satan and his army were cast into the earth. This earth is a place of restraint for them. Jude 6 says, "The angels which kept not their first estate, but left their own habitation, he has reserved in everlasting chains under darkness unto the judgment of the great day." 1 Samuel 2, verse 10. Remember what came out of the throne? What came out of the throne? Not you. My wife has heard this. This is her fourth hearing of this sermon. She's getting it. Lightning and thunder. It says 1 Samuel 2, verse 10, "The adversaries of the Lord shall be broken in pieces." That was the devil and his angels. "From heaven he will thunder against them. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth." Now this just knocked my socks off. What came out of the throne? What's the symbol? What's the expression of God's sovereignty? Speak up. You can talk. Lightning. Thunder and lightning. Luke 10 and verse 17. Jesus has sent out the 70 who followed him on a missionary expedition, a training mission. And in verse 17, they return. "The 70 returned again with joy, saying, 'Lord, even the devils are subject to us through your name.' And he said to them, 'I beheld Satan as lightning fall from heaven.'" Lightning is the expression of God's sovereignty. God didn't just throw him down to earth. He threw him down to earth on a lightning bolt. He made a statement. The throne is symbolic of God's sovereignty, and the thunder and the lightning emanating from it are an expression of that sovereignty. God gave Satan a stinging rebuke, a public spectacle, and a warning to anyone else. I guess at this time, anyone else would have been angels. I think this is before the creation of humans. In Colossians 2, verse 16, verse 15, Colossians 2, 15, it says, "Having disarmed principalities and powers." He's talking about angelic forces, angelic factions. He disarmed principalities and power, and he made a public spectacle of them. When he threw Satan back down to earth on a lightning bolt, he was making an example. He was turning Satan into a public spectacle, triumphing over them in it. Satan challenged God's authority, his sovereignty, and God beat him and made a statement. In Isaiah 14, verse 12, he says, "How you are fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning, how you are cut down to the ground, you who weakened the nations." So by doing this on a lightning bolt, God was expressing the reality of his sovereignty, not just defeating an adversary. So Satan was the first to challenge God's supremacy, his authority, his sovereignty. Now, I've given this sermon, this is the fourth time now, and every time I want to come up with the word sovereignty, old age syndrome begins. I have a hard time remembering that one word. So, Adam, of all people, was the second one to challenge God's autonomy. Adam also was attracted by the possibility of being equal to God, just like Satan. I've often wondered why Adam ate the fruit. I don't know if I gave a sermon here about the two atoms. That's a biblical principle of theology. There are two atoms. You can read about it in Romans and in 1 Corinthians 15. Paul talks about the two atoms. There was Adam, of course, and Jesus Christ is the second Adam. So we need to be thinking about Jesus Christ as the second Adam. So I've often wondered why Adam ate the fruit. Let's look at Genesis 3. There are some hints here. You think, why did Adam eat the fruit? Why did he let his wife eat the fruit? Genesis 3, verse 4, the serpent is making a sales pitch to Eve. And we don't know that this is the first time that he talked to her about it. My thinking is that pull off a con job like this, that it might have taken some time. Maybe he had to make the sales pitch repeatedly. But in any case, the serpent said to the woman in verse 4, Eve has just said that if we eat the tree, fruit of the tree in the middle of the garden, God says we'll die. And the serpent contradicts God. The serpent said to the woman, you aren't going to die. Does God tell you that? You know, I go all over the place and I've got to correct these things that God has said. He just doesn't present the truth in the right way. And, you know, he's trying to exploit you. Verse 5, God knows in the day that you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you shall be like gods, knowing good and evil. Now, it says, 1 Timothy 2:14 says that Eve was deceived, but it says that Adam wasn't deceived. So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, so part of her motivation is, Adam keeps asking her every night, what's for dinner? It's good for food. The tree was good for food. It was pleasant to the eyes and to be desired to make one wise. She took of it and did eat, and she also gave unto her husband, it says with her, her husband who was there with her. Adam was standing right beside her. When the devil was making his sales pitch, Adam heard everything the devil said. Adam was not deceived. Eve was. Eve was deceived. Adam was ambitious. Adam heard the devil say, you'll be like God. That's what he wanted. That's why he ate the fruit. He was grasping at equality with God. And I say that because it explains a verse in Philippians that I have struggled to understand sometimes. So the devil tells Eve, God said you're going to die. You can never really rely on what he says. Eve gave the fruit to her husband who was there with her. He heard the whole thing. She was deceived. He was ambitious. Eve was befuddled. She said, the serpent beguiled me. Adam was calculating. Adam was not deceived. 1 Timothy 2:14. He was ambitious. Like the devil, he was striving for equality with God. He was challenging the sovereignty of God. It's God's sovereign right to say what is good and what is evil. Adam wanted to take a piece of that for himself and determine for himself what was good and what was evil. He was challenging one of the sovereign prerogatives of God, the definition of what is good and what is evil. Let's look at Philippians 2:6, because I think this idea that there were two Adams helps to explain this scripture in Philippians 2:6. Talking about Jesus, I'm reading from the English Standard Version. I think the new translations, you got two sets of translations, the old translations and the new translations. And I think in this case, the new translations get it right. They say Jesus. Now, if you're reading King James, New King James, the sense of what you're reading will be different than what I'm going to read to you right here from the English Standard Version. Jesus, who though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God, a thing to be grasped. Now, why does he say that? Because Paul, although he doesn't think about it, he doesn't state it here, he's thinking about the contrast between the first Adam and Jesus, the last Adam. The first Adam did grasp at equality with God. He ate the fruit, calculating, ambitious, wanting to be equal in some sense to God. That's why he ate the fruit. He was grasping at equality with God. But Philippians 2:6 says Jesus did not grasp at equality with God. So Adam, by eating the forbidden fruit, expected to be able to define good and evil for himself, a godly prerogative. The actual result was that he lost paradise, he was driven out, he was denied access to the tree of life. He found death for us all. They were cursed. They lost intimate contact from God. They became estranged from God. Genesis 3:24. Here's an important principle. Anybody ever hear of the novel written in the early 50s, East of Eden? Who's heard of that book? East of Eden, John Steinbeck. Why did he say East of Eden? Because it's a well-known biblical phenomenon that as you move to the east, you're moving farther away from the presence of God. A biblical principle. Now, somebody call, every time I give this sermon, somebody calls me on this. So, hang tight. So he drove the man, this is Genesis 3:24. He drove out the man and he placed at the east of the Garden of Eden cherubs and a flaming sword which turned every way to keep the way of the tree of life. Moving to the east. Now the temple and the Garden of Eden had the same basic floor plan. The entrance was on the east. It had a holy place in the middle. It was in the midst of the garden where the two trees were, where Adam and Eve met and communed with God. Same as in the temple. The midst of the garden corresponds to the Holy of Holies in the temple. And as I said, that both the temple and the Garden of Eden had the same basic floor plan. Holy place in the middle, exit on the east side. When Adam and Eve left the Garden of Eden, it was like leaving the temple. They left out the east entrance. Moving east, here's another important principle. Moving to the east in Genesis is symbolic of leaving the presence of God. Moving east is symbolic of leaving the blessings of God. This is an important point in the next challenge to God's authority. So Adam and Eve moved east of the garden. You remember that after Cain killed Abel, he moved east. Lot, when Lot left Abraham, he moved east. So in Genesis, moving east is symbolic of moving away from the presence of God. That's an important point in the next challenge to God's authority, which is still in Genesis. Let's turn to Genesis 11. The next challenge to God's sovereignty. It's Genesis 11. I'll start reading in verse 1. The whole earth was of one language and one speech, and it came to pass as they journeyed from the east. Now I get called on this when I give it. It says from the east. They did. Hebrew is a very imprecise language. We have 7 times more words in our English vocabulary than there are in the Hebrew vocabulary, and I've said jokingly that Hebrew must be only slightly more effective as a communication tool than pointing and grunting. Because this verse, where it says journeyed from the east, the word from the east can just as well mean eastward. And in fact, that's what it does mean. All the commentaries say that they journeyed eastward. So you see, man is still moving to the east, still moving away from the influence of God, still moving away from the presence of God, still moving away from the blessings of God. They're moving eastward. You might want to make a little note in your Bible. They didn't journey from the east. They were journeying to the east. If you look up the Hebrew word in your concordance, it'll say from the east. All the commentaries say they were moving toward the east. They found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. Somebody said, well, these people were probably in Turkey, and if they were moving to Babylon, they were moving southeast. Well, look, you don't have an argument with me if that's what you think. You got an argument with Moses, okay? So in the kingdom, you can argue that point with Moses. Moses said they're moving to the east. So I'll let Moses answer that one for you, okay? They found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there, and they said to one another, go, let's make brick and burn them thoroughly. They had brick, they had slime. That means tar. Slime is tar. Slime for mortar. I defy you to build a brick building using tar for mortar. I think that they were tarring the joints between the bricks. Why? Why do you do that on your house? When you build a house with a basement, you put tar. They were trying to make it waterproof, weren't they? They were trying to thwart the will of God just in case God decided to flood them out again. They were going to make a waterproof tower. They tarred the inside of this thing to make it waterproof. Let's build a city and a tower whose top may reach up unto heaven. Now, was that a realistic idea to build a tower up to heaven? It wasn't realistic. It was symbolic. They were making an assault on heaven symbolically. They're building a tower because the tower points up toward heaven and it's in the direction of heaven. It was a symbolic gesture in defiance of God, whose top may reach unto heaven. Let us make a name, lest we be scattered upon the face of the whole earth. Well, that was God's intent, that humankind would branch out over the whole earth and repopulate the earth. We'll see that in a second. The Lord came down to see the city and the tower with the children of men had builded, and God becomes alarmed, and he scatters them. God is sovereign in the affairs of humankind. Man was trying to thwart God's purpose, trying to concentrate themselves all in one spot, trying to build a tower which could be visible perhaps for miles around, a rallying point, a center of civilization, and have human civilization centered and concentrated around this tower which could have been seen from a great distance away, and the tower which symbolically rose up to God's throne in defiance of him. Well, God scattered them. As I said, eastward migration removes man from God's presence, from God's influence. The examples are Adam, Cain, and Lot, and the people of Babel. Moving to the east is symbolic in the Bible for estrangement from God. Moses observes that they are moving toward the east, indicating they are moving away from God. God sees them as becoming or attempting to become like him and passing their human limits and defying his desires for humankind. One translation says, if they think of something they want to do, it won't be taboo to them anymore. And they're guilty of pride. They want to establish a name. It's mentioned twice. And they want to be concentrated in one place. They want greatness in their numbers and their unity. And they are flouting God's instructions. Genesis 9:1. God told Shem, Ham, and Japheth to repopulate, to replenish the earth. Not just the plain of Shinar, the whole earth. Genesis 9:1. God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. And the people of Babylon are disobeying God and they know it. They intend to build a tower that extends to heaven, making an assault, even if only in symbol, on God's sovereignty, and they're thumbing their nose at God and his instructions and his desires for humankind. They deny that he has sovereignty over the affairs of humankind. And in case God intends to flood them out as he did a couple of hundred years earlier, they've waterproofed their tower with tar. They were daring God to try to thwart their plans. But God confused their language, and they were no longer able to collaborate in the rebellion against God, and they were finally scattered over the whole earth, the thing that they were trying to avoid. God's sovereignty, God's plan for humankind, was not able to be thwarted. They were not able to carry out their challenge to God's authority and autonomy. Now, that must have been somewhere in the realm of 2000 BC, and the next rebellion has not happened yet. It happens 4,000 years in the future from that insurrection against God's sovereignty. But in the end time, there will be a rebellion against the religious authority and autonomy of God. And the individual who carries out this assault on God's sovereignty is known in the Bible as the man of sin. So this is the end time. It hasn't happened yet. It's been predicted. It's predicted by Jesus. It's predicted by Paul. It's predicted by Daniel. The man of sin, spoken of in 2 Thessalonians, believes himself to be God. And he will promote the idea that he is God. And he will demand worship. Now, you remember that Jesus, let's turn to Matthew 24. We'll read what Jesus said. And Jesus indicates to us that a prophecy in the Old Testament is going to be fulfilled not once, but twice. Well, it's going to be partially satisfied, and then there will be a latter fulfillment. I've got to come up with a word. I don't like partially fulfilled. That sounds like an oxymoron, right? That's an oxymoron. Partially fulfilled? Can you partially fill this glass for me? No. Well, Matthew 24, verse 15. Jesus refers to a prophecy of Daniel. And his listeners must have been thinking, what's he talking about? This prophecy was fulfilled 175 years ago. Jesus says in verse 15, "When you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel prophet, stand," important verb, "stand in the holy place." It's led us to think, well, someone's going to erect a statue in the holy place. Well, as a matter of fact, there isn't any holy place right now, is there? So in order for this prophecy to occur, there has to be a holy place. But Jesus says there will be. So he says, when you see the abomination of desolation, stand in the holy place. He says, "Whoso reads, let him understand. Then let them which are in Judea flee into the mountains. And let him which is on the housetop not come down to take anything out of his house. Neither let him which is in the field turn back to take his clothes." So Jesus told us to watch out for something that's going to defile a holy place. Apparently the Jews are going to create a holy place in Jerusalem. Now in the second century, about 175, 170 BC, a Greek, a successor to Alexander the Great, erected a statue of Zeus in the temple that Ezra and Nehemiah era temple. Antiochus Epiphanes erected the statue of Zeus. This was a forerunner, a prototypical fulfillment of what Jesus was describing. Jesus said that this thing was going to stand in the holy place. So Antiochus Epiphanes erected a statue. It was a standing idol in the holy place. So we tend to think, at the end time, the Jews are going to have a holy place and someone's going to erect a statue there because it says it stands. Well, I've been thinking about this. This is my opinion, my speculation, all right? And this is not church doctrine. This is just what I've come to have an opinion about as I've been studying this. Does that mean there's going to be another statue? Let's look at 2 Thessalonians 2. 2 Thessalonians 2, Paul is talking about the end time, and Paul is talking about this guy he calls the man of sin, whom I think is the same person as the false prophet of Revelation. 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 1. Paul says, "Now we beseech you, brethren, by the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, and by our gathering together unto him, that you be not soon shaken in mind or troubled, neither by spirit nor word nor letter from us, as that the day of Christ is at hand. Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come except there is a falling away first, and the man of sin shall be revealed, the son of perdition." Perdition, total destruction. Peter talks about the fires of perdition, fires of total destruction in 2 Peter chapter 3. Listen to this. He opposes God, and he exalts himself above all that's called God. Well, he's trying to do the same thing that Lucifer did, right? He's trying to be higher than God. He exalts himself above all that's called God or all that's worshipped. Now, is a guy like this going to erect a statue in the temple? Wouldn't that, if that statue demands worship, like the statue of Antiochus Epiphanes and the great statue of Nebuchadnezzar, those things, those statues were to be worshipped. But this guy exalts himself above anything else that could be called God. Is he going to erect in the temple something that would compete with his worship? Does that make sense? I don't think so. So that he, as God, sits in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. He sits in the temple. He sits. Paul doesn't mention an idol in the temple. He indicates a man will be there, sitting there. I believe the man of sin, this is just my opinion, it makes sense to me. I believe that the man of sin is the abomination of desolation. What's more abominable, a dumb idol standing up in the temple or a man sitting in the temple saying that he's God, demanding worship? This man of sin himself desecrates the temple by his presence and pretending to be or even believing to be that he is God. And he's going to be a genius, a religious genius, a political genius, and he's going to be powered by the devil. Daniel says of him in Daniel 11:36, "The king shall do according to his will, and he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak marvelous things." Oh, he's got a smooth tongue. He's very convincing. "Against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished. For that is determined, that is determined shall be done." Now, Paul says that this man sits in the temple of God, and Jesus warned us about something standing in the temple. Seems like that shoots my theory in the foot, doesn't it? This guy sits in the temple of God, and he demands the worship that rightly belongs to God, and he exalts himself over every other god, including the true God of heaven and his son Jesus. So I don't think he's going to be erecting statues. I think that the man of sin sitting in the temple of God proclaiming that he is God, he is the abomination of desolation. And in verse 8 of 2 Thessalonians 2, it says that wicked shall be revealed, whom the Lord shall consume with the spirit of his mouth and shall destroy with the brightness of coming, his coming, even him whose coming is after the working of Satan with all power and signs and lying wonders. So this guy will claim to be God, and he backs it up by performing miracles given to him by the devil. Now, Paul talks about the man of sin sitting in the temple of God. Jesus talks about a desecration standing in the temple. And he said, "Flee when you see it standing." Now, you remember the story about how Solomon reigned 40 years and he died and his son Rehoboam took over. And taxes under Solomon had been egregious. And the wise old men, the elders of Israel, came to Rehoboam, Solomon's son, and they said, "This people will love you forever. You just got to do one thing. You got to reduce our taxes. Please, we beg you, reduce the taxes. The taxes under your father were crushing." So he said, "Give me 3 days and then come back and I'll tell you my judgment." So Rehoboam, son of Solomon, consulted with the kids he grew up with. And they said, "Reduce the taxes. Don't do that. Raise the taxes." So after 3 days, the elders come back. They said to Rehoboam, what's your decision? And Rehoboam gives them his decree. Now, do you think they were collegially standing around in a circle when Rehoboam tells them what he's going to do? Where was Rehoboam when he made the judgment, when he made the decree? Where was he? He was on his throne. And these guys are looking up at him. Maybe they're bowing before him. And they're looking up at Rehoboam because what he says when he's on his throne, that's the law. The throne is the symbol of his authority. And when he makes a decree, he makes it from the throne. The throne gives it credibility. The throne gives it weight. So, Paul says the man of sin sits in the temple of God. What's he sitting on? Barco lounger from his mother's basement? Rocking chair, lawn chair, desk chair, bar stool? What's he sitting on? He's sitting on a throne. The man of sin is in the temple of God, sitting on a throne. And that's why Jesus said, when you see the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place, flee to the mountains. Because when he sits on his throne, it's too late. When he sits down on his throne, he's going to start issuing decrees. What do you think the first decree is going to be? Seal off the city with the armies. Send the armies out around the city. Don't let anybody come in or go out. Second decree, find me all those who don't have the mark of the beast. Bring them here. Slay them before me. My opinion. Just my opinion. But the man of sin and the beast will be destroyed in the lake of fire. Revelation 19, verse 19. I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies gathered together to make war against him that sat on the horse, that's Jesus, and against his army. And the beast was taken, and with him the man of sin, the false prophet, that wrought miracles before him, with which he deceived them that had received the mark of the beast and them that worshipped his image. These both were cast alive into the lake of fire burning with brimstone. So God's sovereignty cannot be challenged. It's been challenged 3 times. It will be challenged 3 more times. Maybe if I come down here again, I'll tell you about the last 2, which both happened during the millennium, believe it or not. All the attempts to contest the sovereignty of God are a disaster, a train wreck, death for those who perpetrate it. So, God is sovereign. It means he has both the right and the ability to do whatever he wants to do. He's in control. And no one is able to wrestle from him his authority and his ability to rule. And one very important aspect of that is God's sovereignty in his ability to say what is good and what is evil, what is right and what is wrong. That will never change. It won't change because it is protected by the sovereignty of God. How grateful can we be for that? Jesus says, "I am the eternal, I change not. Therefore, you sons of Jacob are not consumed." We talked about 4 challenges to God's sovereignty. Each one ends in disaster or disappointment for the perpetrators. And God is sovereign in our lives, and we must recognize this. We must accept his influence in our lives, always submitting to his will. rather than resisting it as men and angels have done and will continue to do. We must be grateful that the holy God, the righteous God, will always be in charge. It's because of the unassailable sovereignty of the holy and ethical God, the compassionate God, the faithful God, the Father of all living, that we will be able to live in his kingdom, where the standards of right and wrong will be unchanging for all eternity.